nation. Well, you know, we all want to change the world. But when you talk about destruction, don't you know that you can count me out? Don't you know it's gonna be alright? Alright. Alright. You say you got a real solution. Well, you know, we don't love to see the plan. You ask me for a contribution. Well, you know, we all do what we can. But if you want money for people with minds that hate, all I can tell you is, brother, you have to wait. Alright. Alright.
From the Beatles there, a choice of our guest in this hour, Paul Marshall, Senior Fellow from the Hudson Institute Centre for Religious Freedom. Paul, the Beatles. Now, there's a story behind that, isn't there?
There is. I was, my one and only claim to fame is that I was at school with George Harrison and Paul McCartney. No, because they're older than me, of course. They'd be, you know, when they were 15, they weren't going to talk to a 12-year-old. So I have touched greatness, though greatness has not touched me. And my life has been downhill from the, you know, just a wreck, really.
Well, I've been reading up, I've got to say, and there's lots of interesting things to talk about in this hour. More serious than some of the Beatles' music, I've got to say. Can I begin in looking across your writing? Mm-hmm. It looks like one major focus for you has been ideology and religion.
Yes.
Ideology. Mm-hmm. Now, what's gotten you into that area?
Because I'm religious myself, and I'm an Episcopalian in America, and historically, my doctorate's in political philosophy. It was on the influence of theology on English political thought. I see these influences sort of everywhere, and see lots of people not noticing them or misunderstanding them. Religion and politics are always and everywhere intertwined, and they will never be untwined. We can get into that. The key is, how should they be related, and how do we understand them? So that's, in terms of a lot of my academic work when I used to be a professor, that's the sort of thing I've been looking at. And then you look at the contemporary world now, where they're so intertwined. My simple way of putting it is, if you want to understand the modern world, you have to understand religion.
Oh, you're a perfect guest for our program, well, because that's what we focus on. Thank you very much. Okay. Can I touch on a few of the thorny issues, I suppose, that I've come across as you've tried to approach them, understand them, and reason about them? Islam has been a focus of study and how it operates. Let's begin there.
Okay. And background for that, one of my big things I look at is issues of religious freedom internationally, globally. Things can be very bad in many places, in Vietnam or China, in Burma, Sudan, Saudi Arabia. But the area where religious repression is growing is in the Muslim world. You know, Vietnam is not trying to get other people to do what it does. It doesn't care what others do. It cares what bad happens at home. But the extremist forms of Islam, which have grown and I think are still growing, have an export model. They want other Muslims to be like them. They want to persuade them to do that. If they won't be persuaded, they may kill them. But they want sort of a particular reactionary view of Islam imposed on the Muslim world and then outside the Muslim world. So it's growing, it's spreading. So for that reason, I've spent a lot of attention in the last 10, 15 years on Islam, on the Muslim world, both dealing with terrorism. I started writing about terrorism because after the attacks in the U.S. on what's called 9/11, all the groups people were talking about, I knew about. I knew about these groups. I knew about Al-Qaeda.
You'd already been studying them.
Yes, because of religious freedom. I wasn't like a terrorism expert, national security guy, any of these things. But I could tell you how many churches had been bombed in Indonesia, and it was dozens. A group called Lashkar Jihad did that, and that had been killing people elsewhere. Oh. If I looked at the Sudan, I know Bin Laden. He was in Sudan for many years. He had connections with the slave trade in Sudan. So suddenly, groups which were new to almost everywhere, I knew them not as a terrorism guy, but as a religious freedom guy. And so I pursued those elements. So let me just mention, I've got a book coming out in October this year called Silenced. Mm-hmm. Subtitle, How Blasphemy Restrictions Are Choking Freedom Worldwide, Freedom of Religion and Freedom of Speech. And this addresses in the Muslim world, but then in the West concerning Islam, that people are shut up if they're thought to be insulting religion or defaming religion, particularly Islam. And we may call it hate speech or defaming religion, but it's blasphemy laws like they have in Pakistan and other places. And the survey is meant to show how widespread these are and how strong their effect is. And when you think of insulting religion and who might be doing this, don't think of an idiot Florida pastor who burns Korans. Okay, I mean, that is insulting religion. He's not typical. He's unusual. Think of somebody else like the former governor of the largest province in Pakistan. Over half the population of the country are in Punjab province. Salman Taseer.
Assassinated.
Was assassinated for opposing the blasphemy law. And a quote from his daughter, Sarah, who said, "This is a message to every liberal. Shut up or be shot." That's one of the things the blasphemy law is about. You know, the victims aren't insulters in the sense we usually talk about. They're people like Taseer, you know, a courageous Democrat. And then the only Christian cabinet minister in Pakistan, the minister of minorities, Shahbaz Bhatti.
Assassinated.
So this is what we're talking about. And we're talking about Pakistani journalists. We're talking about Afghan journalists. We're talking about the intelligentsia in Egypt, who write about ways they should interpret the Quran. And the one Abu Zayd, who we include a section on him in the book, had to flee Egypt because of his writings. He was a committed Muslim, but radicals said, "These writings show you're not a Muslim, therefore you're an apostate, so you can't be married to a Muslim." And they got a court declaration that he was forcibly divorced from his wife. He fled, and his wife, to the Netherlands. This is who we're talking about.
You have quoted him in some of your writing.
Yes.
Where he says, "Having been at the receiving end of such allegations, as in blasphemy and apostasy, and driven from my home in Egypt to exile in the Netherlands, I can state with conviction that charges of apostasy and blasphemy are key weapons in the fundamentalists' arsenal, strategically employed to prevent reform of Muslim societies."
Yep.
That's tough stuff coming from a Muslim.
Yeah, and it is. He's a victim. And to mention, the foreword to the book is written by Abdullah Ram Wahid, colloquially known as Gastur. Former president of the world's largest Muslim country, Indonesia. Former president of the world's largest Muslim organization, Nahdlatul Ulama. The last thing he wrote before he died is the foreword to this book, because he also argues eloquently. He says, "These are laws which stifle Muslim societies. And even in Indonesia, comparatively open societies." When I go to, last time I was in Indonesia, they had me on a radio program for Ramadan, a three-part, you know, interviewing someone who's not a Muslim, discussing Ramadan. It's still a very open society. But now you're getting Ahmadiyyas, who are sort of dissident, maybe heretical Muslims, being killed in Indonesia, of all places. Attacks on churches. So Gus Dorr was well aware of this, and you know, he provided this introduction. This is a problem we've got to fight within the Muslim world. And one of our big worries now is that the West is sliding into importing these things. We're saying, well, we should stop insulting religion. That's bad. Well, it is bad. But you try and make laws around that, and you will be locking up, you will be shutting down, you know, any discussion about politics and religion insofar as it deals with Islam.
Well, I do want to pick up there, and I want to put on my big rubber hands as an interviewer and just point out that when I first started reading your stuff, I thought, oh, is this guy anti-Muslim? It was my first worry that I would find somewhere where you went right off the rails. I was sort of worried that was going to be the case. Now, you've mentioned Gusto, Abdulrahman Wahid. You've mentioned many Muslim friends of yours. I just want to say straight out that from my reading, it became clear to me that you're not anti-Islam.
No, I'm not. The big conflict in the world today, in sort of religion and violence, is within Islam. And you have major figures like Abu Zayd, major figures like Gus Dorr. I'll mention another person that this is, we're talking about the forthcoming book, Silenced, which is authored. But in writing that book, we thought we're surveying what happens in the contemporary world, but we do need to make an argument that Islam does not require civil penalties for apostasy or blasphemy. You can throw them out of your mosque or whatever. I think people are free to do that. But the government shouldn't be involved. And I'm not equipped to make that argument from Muslim history and Muslim text. So I asked Abu Zayd, would he write one, which he did. Another person who wrote an essay on this is actually an Australian, Abdullahi Saeed, who teaches at the University of Melbourne. Mm-hmm. He and his brother wrote a book saying, you know, on Islamic Muslim grounds, that there should be no civil penalty for apostasy for leaving Islam. And so he gave that essay. And another example of who gets repressed, he wrote that with his brother, who was then the Attorney General of the Maldives.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, that book is now banned in the Maldives. Okay, a book written by the Attorney General making an argument, you're not allowed to read it. This is what's going on, and that's why so many Muslims want to fight these blasphemy laws.
Without going out of my door, I can know all things on earth. Without looking out of my window, I can know the ways of heaven. The farther one travels, the less one knows. The less one really knows.
The Beatles, their choice of our guest, Dr. Paul Marshall from the Hudson Centre Institute for Religious Freedom, here on ABC Local Radio around Australia with me, Noel Debien. Paul Marshall, you've not only written about Islam, though, because this is about ideology. You've also written on Hinduism. Now, why Hinduism?
Firstly, Hinduism is generally a very open religion. And for many Hindus, you could be a Christian and a Hindu. Obviously, you could be a Buddhist and a Hindu, because they Buddhism, many of them think it's a subset of that. But you get radical Hindus. That's who killed Gandhi.
Hindu nationalism has become an issue, hasn't it?
Yeah, you get these very, called the sort of saffron wave, the Sangh Parivar in India. So you get very radical groups. The largest religious paramilitary groups in the world are in India. So in this very peaceful, open land, you get extremist Hindu groups, which often target Muslims. You know, 2,000 Muslims were killed in really a pogrom where the government stood aside in India. And
you're talking about Ayodhya.
So following on from Ayodhya, the other things. And these things continue. So there's violence there. So I wrote a sort of book-length story, with Indians who wrote on this booklet called The Rise of Hindu Extremism, and deals with Hindu extremist attacks on Muslims and Christians in India. One story,
had an Australian missionary murdered, by the way.
Graham Staines, yes. Yeah. Mm. And he was killed by these same groups. And, you know, as a sort of foreigner, as a missionary, you know, this guy had been there 30 years. He worked with lepers.
And well-known and friendly to all around him.
Yes. And I remember, these radical groups killed him. The guy who led it was basically
a
bandit.
And his kids, I recall.
Yeah, too. They were burnt to death inside their vehicle. Mm. Children were burnt to death. At the funeral, about every village within walking distance closed down and they went to the funeral. Because these are the people he worked with. He worked with leprosy patients. He was a beloved man. But for these groups, he's a Christian. He must be doing something bad here. He's a foreigner. So he was murdered. Yeah, this is the sort of person anybody would want to imitate. Yeah, this can be really, really bad. So you have Hindu extremists. You've got Buddhist extremists.
I was just about to say to you, now what about Buddhism, that well-known peaceful religion? And, of course, Sri Lanka has been a place where even extremism has emerged among Buddhists.
Yeah, you've had attacks on Hindu. Yeah, with the sort of the civil war in Sri Lanka. Most of that was sort of ethnic and language with Tamil groups and Sinhalese groups.
It's often tied together, though, isn't
it? Yeah, but it's also a Hindu-Buddhist divide. Mm-hmm. And Sinhalese Buddhism in Sri Lanka has a very distinct form of Buddhism, very much tied in with Sri Lankan nationalism. And they feel threatened by outsiders. So you have Buddhist monks, you know, leading mobs to burn down Pentecostal churches in Sri Lanka. So Buddhism is not always peaceful. I would say, by and large, Buddhism is peaceful. Of religions in the world, has one of the best records on religious freedom. A sort of Buddhist country which persecuted, that's usually because it's communist, like China, not because it's Buddhist. But still, like any group, you will find extremist elements there. So, and you do have a militant trend in Buddhism, in Tibet, in Burma. Monks were often armed and were quite capable of fighting, and they formed armies. They were the shock troops. Mm. Same thing, you know, going back to Europe and Christianity.
Of
particularly
course.
The Orthodox monks, they were the fanatic troops in the vanguards, you know, fighting against Muslims. The Muslims said, oh no, it's monks.
Well,
our image is sometimes way out of tune.
The religion wars are not over yet. Bosnia-Herzegovina is an excellent example of Christians taking up arms to murder over religious ideology as well.
It is. And you get, brings up a thing. You had Andrej Breivik in Norway, who was described as Christian fundamentally, certainly not that. He's a sort of cultural, he sees Europe as Christian and wants to defend its heritage, while saying himself he's not particularly religious. But it makes this point, a lot of religious persecution is carried out by people who are not particularly religious in the sense of pious. Mm. So Breivik is killing people in the name of Christian Europe, though he says himself he's not really a believer. The Serbs who are killing Muslims and Catholics, the Croats, and I mean, everybody did bad
everybody
things.
Everybody was killing each other, of course.
It is. The Serbs did worse, maybe because they had the army, but you have Orthodox Christians killing Catholic Christians, killing Muslims, killing Orthodox Christians. Most of these people are not pious. Hmm. The old joke was, what's the difference between a Serb, a Croat, and a Bosniak? The Serb doesn't go to the Orthodox Church. The Croat doesn't go to the Catholic Church,
of course.
And the Bosniak will not be found near the mosque.
Well, of course, I can just hear already listeners sitting at home saying, no, the real problem is religion. That's the real problem. Where do all the wars come from? Where does all the trouble come from? Now, how do you answer those sorts of objections?
Oh, that's easy. It's wrong. It's mistaken. It's flat out false. At two levels. One of the things I do in my job is do surveys of religious freedom around the world. I've done two, the second one about 2 years ago. We cover 100 countries. This is not war at the moment, but religious repression. Who are the most religiously repressive countries in the world? The sort of theocratic ones, places like Saudi Arabia, Iran, and the secular ones, North Korea, China, Vietnam. If you have a country which is secularism isn't necessarily atheist, but let's put it this way. The atheist countries in the world tend to be the most highly repressive. North Korea is worse than the most reactionary, you know, Muslim place you could find. You have secular terrorists. You know, nationalism, you can have religious nationalists, you can have secular nationalism, and those are terrorists too. The Basques are not killing people in the name of religion. It's in the name of the Basque people.
Ireland, the IRA.
I'm not arguing that there are no religious conflicts.
Yes.
I'm saying that the idea that these conflicts are tied to religion misses the boat.
You're rejecting the idea that the essence of them is the religious impulse. Yeah. That's what you're saying.
Human beings will kill you because of belief, because of money, because of power, because of sex. And secularist movements are as murderous as any. and in the last century were far more murderous than any. You know, communism is a secular movement. In its history, you know, killed many more people than even the Nazis did. The dividing line in terms of war and conflict is not between the religious person and the secular person, but the one who believes you should kill somebody else over a matter of belief and the ones who don't.
Well, given that we've touched on pretty much all the world's major religions now, and we've found that in each there's a history or even a present activity where the ideologue or the extremist will kill.
Yep.
Why is it, do you think, that Islam is copying so much in the Western press in particular?
Because there's much more of it.
Is it in its nature? What do you mean?
No, I don't think it's in its nature. I mean, historically, Islam has had a much stronger association with government than other religions. That, you know, God is seen as giving you the law, of giving you the true form of rule. So it gets political very easily, very quickly, right from the beginning. You know, it took Christianity 300 years with Constantine to become so connected with the state. In Islam, it happens from the beginning. So the question of religion-related violence occurs much earlier within Islam. Also within Islam, from about the 11th to 12th century on, there was a sort of closing of ijtihad, of interpretation. So in many areas of Islam, until recent centuries, but more likely decades, there hasn't been much discussion, interpretation of responding to what goes on outside. A third element is this, that for its first 1,000 years, Islam was the world's dominant civilization and culture. Militarily, in terms of wealth, in terms of intellect and other things. The Christian world was sort of marginal.
Disorganized, even.
Disorganized. Oh, the heartland was, of course, controlled by Muslims. The Middle East was Christian before the Muslims arrived. So a 1,000 years of stunning success, followed by 400 years of crippling failure. That is, most of the world's sort of league tables, Muslim countries, particularly Arab ones, not necessarily Muslim countries as a whole, are near the bottom. You know, in the 19th...
Economically, you mean?
Economically, in terms of prosperity. A measure of prosperity, you know, it's oil or poverty. But in terms of human rights, in terms of democracy tables, in terms of religious freedom, they score near the bottom. And in the 1920s, just over 100 years ago, from being a sort of world civilization, in the 1920s, there were only four areas of the world actually run by Muslims. Turkey and Iran were two of them, but they were extremely secular. So this sort of leaves you with sort of Saudi Arabia and Yemen, really, which are really one territory. So Saudi Arabia is in many ways the only part of the Muslim world which wasn't controlled by unbelievers.
Ever.
And so you have this proud religion, civilization, reduced to being the bottom. So there's a sense of shame, humiliation, but also, why?
Why has this happened to us?
How come we were sort of on top in so many ways, and now why has it happened to us? So this sort of breeds radicalism, being, you know, controlled, being invaded by foreigners.
Well, I can hear Osama bin Laden's arguments already. I can tell you why. I can quote him back to you why this has happened. Colonialism. The unbeliever.
It's the unbelievers, but also the apostates within, even more. Who does he hate most? Ataturk. Mustafa Kemal Ataturk. Why? Because he abolished the caliphate in 1920. Al-Qaeda's manual begins on March the 3rd, 1924. The caliphate, the nominal, often it was, he wasn't really running the Muslim world, but in principle, there was some guy who ruled the Muslims, so the Muslims were one people, and Ataturk gets rid of it. So, you know, this is the sort of beginning grievance, and then, you know, Osama bin Laden says, the only area of the Muslim world where the infidels had never trod, the land of the two mosques, Saudi Arabia, the Holy Land. The Saudis allowed infidel armies in. Who is this? The Americans come in to defend them from Saddam Hussein.
In the Kuwaiti crisis, of course.
Yes, with Kuwait. And for him, he says, that was the greatest insult. It's not the Palestinians. It's sort of the infidel
Saudis.
Feet trod
Indeed.
On the Holy Land. So Osama bin Laden saw the world in that way. And often, again, we misunderstand him. We treat him as if he were like a third world liberation theology, the sort of Frantz Fanon of the late 20th century. He isn't. He's an he was an apocalyptic religious warrior.
There's a lot to take in there. Let's take another little piece of the Beatles and relax for a moment, and we'll rally again.
I've got a word or two to say about the things that you do.
Think for yourself, George Harrison. And if you've just joined us, Harrison was a classmate of our guest, Paul Marshall, from the Hudson Centre Institute for Religious Freedom, here on ABC Local Radio with me, Noel Debien. Paul Marshall, we've talked through the ideology of religions, and we've spent a fair bit of time on Islam for the reasons you've just discussed. But another issue you raise is the media and our failure to get at the real story in religion, politics, and their interaction. What are your concerns here?
Two things. One is an argument we make is that religion is increasingly important throughout the world, in personalized, but focus here is more on the political side. And there are exceptions. Australia may be one. I'm not. Western Europe's another. But in the world at large, the importance of religion is increasing. When you get democratization, it increases even more. Because the population is usually more religious than the elite. So that's increasing. So this means for many contemporary news stories, we've talked about terrorism as one, but if you look at, say, coverage of the war in Iraq, often they didn't know what was going on. They weren't really sure what Shiites were and weren't aware of the tremendous difference between Iraqi Shiites and Iranian Shiites.
You're talking about our newsrooms, basically.
I'm talking about our newsrooms.
Yeah.
I mean, our politicians too, but here we're talking about the newsrooms. In terms of understanding American elections or American politics generally, that religion is a much better determinant of voting in America. If you want to know how someone votes, ask them about their religion. Don't ask them about their income or their class. That has an effect too, but religion has a large effect. You know, looking at movies, we actually have a chapter on Mel Gibson. But looking at more recent movies and who's talked about, Terrence Malick, who's much talked about, highly intelligent movie maker. His latest book is called The Tree of Life, his sort of visual meditation on the book of Genesis. Mm-hmm. You know, Malick is Assyrian in background, an Iraqi Christian. Mm. And I often find, I'm not a skilled movie reviewer, but I often find when I've seen a movie and I'm reading a review of saying, there's religious overtones here, well, not just overtones, undertones, and right in the middle, and people had not seen that. Mel Gibson's movie, The Passion of the Christ, was major discussion in the United States, saying it wasn't faithful to the New Testament, and it was a misreading. It could ignite anti-Semitism, which it didn't. But what it was structured on was the Stations of the Cross.
Oh, there were also influences of Blessed Katerina Emmerich, though.
Yes, there were.
An unusual mystic, weren't
they? Oh, yeah. That was a weird one. It gets tied into his sort of Mel's
his particular
unusual
spirituality.
Catholicism.
Yeah.
But the actual structure, if you go through it, the set piece scene would obvious to a Catholic who knows the stations.
Oh, I found it deeply moving.
Yeah, it's just, it's right there. But people, it says, it's not a New Testament narrative in the sense of the Gospels, which have many things. It's the structured liturgical narrative of the Stations of the Cross.
Of course, yeah.
And people didn't notice that. And I don't expect, you know, a reporter covering city politics in Sydney to know that. But you're going to write about, you know, a movie about the death of Christ. Someone should have read up on that. So even in movies...
Missing on a movie critique, you're saying there's something very obvious which is not being mentioned here.
Yeah. So, you know, much of this is across the board. And we're finding, the sociologists are finding, even in, you know, secular societies like Western Europe and... I would hazard the guess, even Australia, most of the people are still very religious. They don't want to go to church, but actually they don't want to go to anything organized. So, you know, people have been at home for a while. We've asked people, do they believe in God? Do they pray? These sorts of questions.
Do they have a sense of spirituality?
You ask, ask a spirituality question, and that, you know, then you're bouncing up the 70s and 80s.
And it's true that what you say is corroborated in voluntary groups and in civil society in general. There's a falling away of commitment to public groupings, basically, and institutions, let it be said.
Yeah, in a place like Australia, I think it's true there is a sort of loss of religious faith, a number of religious people. But there's also a phenomenon that it's changing. It's still there. It's much less expressed in people showing up on a Sunday morning.
Why is this critical in media, though, particularly in our news reporting and our current affairs? Because we've mentioned movie review and the media missing these things.
Yep.
But why is it very important, from your point of view, that our journalists understand the religious subtext, or in fact the motivations that are going on here? Let me give you an example.
Yep.
I was fascinated when I really looked into the Iranian Revolution, and I began to understand more about its particular brand of Shiite Islam, my eyes were opened as to why the Ayatollah had so much influence. The Mahdi.
Yes. And the Mahdi is, to use a Christian term which doesn't fit, but is this sort of messianic figure, not necessarily the one at the end of times, but the coming of the holy figure, the saint, who will restore the glory of the Muslim world. In Shiite Islam, you also have the notion of the hidden imam, who's waiting to reappear.
Still waiting, he's coming.
And Ahmadinejad is very big on this. Many Iranians are, but that's very big for him. Enough so, and you know, there's a huge power struggle within the government of Iran right now, and several of Ahmadinejad's the president. His aides have been accused of sorcery by people allied with the supreme leader, Khamenei. Why? Because they think, partly it's politically to undercut them.
We've read this here, the sorcery charges.
Yes. And the views of the hidden imam are getting so weird and strange, and the things they're trying to do, it's becoming magic, not Islam. So this is seriously meant, and this debate is going on here. And I'm great, you know, we've had it here, but...
There yet could be blood spilled over this, too.
There could be blood spilled. There could be a regime could crack on this. Yeah, not nukes, not the other stuff, but whether there's too much sorcery going on in the president's office. And I've seen this, I've seen reporting in the mainstream media on this, but largely this is missed. You know, sorcery does not compute. You get a lot of sorcery charges in Saudi Arabia too, by the way.
And you're arguing that at the basis of those who are people of faith, whether that's organized religion or not, that there are motivations which are driving people, is what you're basically saying, and the media is oftentimes missing these motivations, these significant ones.
Yeah. And my most sort of oversimplified formulation is four things drive human beings: money, sex, power, and faith. Media tends to think it must be money, sex, and power. Often don't notice faith, but if they do, they think it's a cover for something else. It's a sort of Marxism, needn't be left-wing, but
it's sort of
religion
fake.
Is the superstructure. We need to look at the real things underneath. It's evanescent. Religion doesn't make people do something. It's a false consciousness, disguising the fact that they're really doing something. Now, often that's true. I mean, I interact with enough religion to know that things can be a cover for there are frauds. And all But the problem is it tends to be read out of court and saying we must look for the real motivation, which couldn't be religion.
Dr. Paul Marshall, we've run out of time. I would love to carry this conversation on again, and we'll endeavour to have you back again. It's been a fascinating journey into motivations of religious belief, and thank you very much for being part of the program.
Thank you so much for having me.